Hello, everybody. Welcome to our session. Let me introduce myself. I'm Donna Kaminsky. I'm a family medicine physician. I'm faculty at Robert Wood Johnson University Hospital, Somerset, with their residency program. Certainly consider myself a primary care provider, and certainly consider myself a primary care provider. I'm very interested in building my skill set around rheumatoid arthritis. And I'm really fortunate to be here with Dr. Prabhakaran, who is a rheumatologist. And I'm going to let Dr. Prabhakaran introduce herself.
Hi everyone, this is Sajina Prabhakaran. I'm a rheumatologist at Capital Health, rheumatology specialist, and I work out of Hopewell and in New Jersey. And I'm thrilled to be here with Dr. Kaminsky to talk about rheumatoid arthritis.
Wonderful. Welcome. Dr. Prabhakaran, thank you so much. These sessions have been really, really helpful. Thank you for going through diagnosis, treatment with us, which I really feel has been really, really critical in helping us to sort of, as I said, build our skill set around managing rheumatoid arthritis in our patients. One of the things that I'm finding, so many of the patients that that I serve not only in training but now as an attending, struggle with compliance with many of their medications. And so with rheumatoid arthritis, I know that this is also an issue. Can you talk a little bit about what you've seen in terms of being helpful to help increase and improve compliance with medication, especially in a chronic disease such as rheumatoid arthritis?
Absolutely. Yeah, compliance is one of those great challenges that I think all physicians of all specialties they deal with our patients. We can do everything right and we can say everything right in the 20-minute visit, but the patient, once they leave, we don't quite know if they're following through with what's been told. So it depends a lot on what the reason is behind a non-compliance. It could be one, it could be just a lack of understanding of what they should be doing or why they should be doing or how they should be doing. Polypharmacy, as we know, can lead to poor compliance. Financial burden. Sometimes the medications are just too expensive for a patient. They have a very high copay, or they don't, may not have a high copay, but they have 20 medications to purchase and they cannot afford all 20 meds. So they're picking and choosing what they're going to take that particular week or month. It could be side effects that they're not voicing to the physician, but decide that they're not going to take the medicine because it's just the easier thing to do. It could be cultural, it could be social. There are several reasons for compliance. So one of the jobs as a physician, I think the way when a patient walks in, I think we all do this, is we ask open-ended questions as to what do you take? What is the medication that you take every day? And asking them what, how do you take it? Well, how many do you take? So that will give us an idea if they're truly taking the medication at the state they are or if they're not. And also always maintaining an open dialogue with the patient so that they feel comfortable telling us if they are not taking a medication and as to why they are not taking it, so that we can address the issue. And one of the important things about improving compliance is that the patient understands what's going on with them and why they need to take the medication. If one doesn't understand, it's highly unlikely that they are going to follow through with instructions. So one of the things that we want to invest our time in during every visit is at least going through a brief overview of what it is that they have and what's the importance or the necessity of taking a medication and what it is that we're looking for. Sometimes patients are taking meds and they don't know why they're taking it. They will tell us, well, I don't know how I'm supposed to feel, but I'm taking it. Well, then you enumerate it. This is why we're giving it to you. It's sometimes we assume that the patient understands or knows these facts. But and not everybody is at the same level of, you know, education or expertise or viewpoint. So explaining that to the patient, educating the patient will definitely feel them more empowered and help to increase their sense of responsibility to follow through on these instructions. As we all know now, we have Dr. Google also, which can really be very helpful, or sometimes can be one of our biggest problems. Is that patients can sometimes you can talk to them about the drug, tell them everything they need to know, and then they go and they Google the drug's name and they see something on a website and they come back and say, nope, I'm not taking it because someone said this about this medication. So making sure that the patient understands, educating them as to where do you want to go look for information, where do you want to, what do you want to avoid. So giving them that direction so that they are aware that there is information out there, but not every piece of information is reliable. So as a physician, keeping that open dialogue with the patient is extremely important so that the patient feels that they are being heard, that they're being listened to, and that they're being, that their viewpoints are taken into consideration when we as physicians are educating them and informing them what they should do. I don't want to use the word telling them. I'd rather say informing them.
Informing, yeah.
On how they should be doing and what they should be doing to help themselves. And when it comes to cost, there are ways to get around that. I'm not sure if you're going to come and talk about that a little bit later.
Okay. Yes, we will. We'll talk about it a little bit later. You know, I think if I can like just step back to Dr. Google, who's I think the most commonly seen doctor in the United States, because you bring out a really important point that I just want to hone in on a little bit more, which is about misconceptions. And I think Dr. Google can help create misconceptions. And it's really, really important that we really hear our patients where they're at and really get a feel for what their conceptions are so that we can sort of walk with them, right? And build from there. What are the most common patient misconceptions that you've found so that we can be aware? And again, we can engage in dialogue with our patients around this and sort of work through those misconceptions.
Yeah. So frequently it's the patient who's most concerned about side effects with medications that I see will resort to Dr. Google because you're trying to, or looking online essentially to find side effects of medicines or adverse reactions that they are, you know, afraid they're going to have, right? So directing a patient in the very beginning, when we talk to the patient about the disease process, providing them with sources of information. So we have plenty of sources online. As a physician, we can print things out from, for example, UpToDate. If you use UpToDate in your office, there's patient information on UpToDate, which is a great tool to print out. It's just 3 pages and tell the patient, hey, listen, this is for you. You can go back and review this. You have any questions, you ask me, and that's important. They're going to read 3 pages and they won't follow everything on it. And to be aware that they can ask questions to you, that would be one good place. And other websites I like to use is WebMD. I like to refer patients to Mayo Clinic, arthritis.org, which is, and of course, rheumatology.org. They are both very, very good websites for patients to go to collect information. And the reason why I give these particular websites is because there are things out there where patients have reported their experiences with medications or their experience with a disease. So there are Facebook pages or there are patient forums that's out there. And that, while it can be very heartening for a patient to read other people like themselves going through a disease process, it can also give you a very skewed view of the disease or of medication. So as long as the patient understands that what one person goes through is not what everyone is going to go through, and keeping that awareness, so the patient has that awareness, it's good. But I try to discourage patients from going on those kind of blogs or forums and sticking to medical websites so they can get a more of a neutral as well as a wholesome and more accurate information about the disease and the drug. To so that they understand what's going on with them.
Yeah, got it. Yeah, that makes sense. Being able to offer them accurate sources of information, and especially we were talking in the last segment about newly diagnosed patients, and especially in a newly diagnosed patient, which it can really be hard for them. They've just received this really big news, sort of like a very big diagnosis that they're going to be caring for a long time. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times they're overwhelmed with emotions and it's very hard for them to remember everything that you've talked mm-hmm. with them about.
Absolutely.
And so I'm just wondering if there are tools that you've seen really helpful with patients, such as maybe bringing a family member so that family member, you know, can capture, or maybe you have them, I've heard about this teach back approach where the patient sort of teaches back, you know, to you what you share them, so that again, that's another tool that can ensure that, you know, they're capturing all this information. And, you know, in addition to, of course, having great written materials, which is what you're describing.
Absolutely. So yeah, besides giving out handouts in the office, a couple of things I do when I call them in for the next appointment, one of the things I do is I ask the patient a little bit about their disease itself. I use keywords like, so how long is your stiffness? or have you had any swelling in their joint? So they know what they're looking for when I ask them these questions. So they know what they need to complain to me about the next time they see me. A couple of other things that I do ask patients to understand better about the disease process also is to ask them about their ADLs, about their, you know, things that seem very, very tangent, like how's your job going on? Or you know, what did you do for your hobby? Are you still doing the sport? This kind of gives us an idea mm-hmm. as to where the patient is with disease activity as a physician, which is important for us because we want to improve their quality of life. If I have a patient who I feel, like you said, is very overwhelmed, and you can get a sense after first one or two visits, you would know right away if this patient is, well, they will tell you, well, I don't know how to manage this. That's what they would use. I don't know how to manage this. I'm very confused. I am overwhelmed. I don't like this. I wish this would just go away. You know, these are all the different phrases that patients use to describe. And sometimes I will ask them to bring a family member in, or I might just call somebody on the phone when the patient is in the room. And can I talk to both of them and say, hey, listen, this is what we're doing. This is what's going on. This is what we're doing. This is what we need to do to get to where we want to get to. And this is how we can get there. And also involving the family member to identify what the obstacles are, what are the barriers that this patient is facing mm-hmm. at home or at their workplace, or maybe they have a very unsupportive partner, or like I said, there are financial issues, or there is, you know, there's their children who are taking a lot of the time. So there could be so many different reasons why somebody is non-compliant. So trying to tease that out, and sometimes it may take more than a visit for us to identify that, which is okay, but at least trying to pursue it, that does help a lot in trying to identify what the issue is primarily that we can address it. And we, you know, if you have social workers available in your office, they can be a great tool so that we're not spending as much time during mm-hmm. a clinic visit doing this. They can help navigate a lot of these other issues that we may not be able to do, or they can do it better than us and provide the patient with the necessary tools and resources to do better with their medications and their disease. Mm-hmm. In terms of, especially my patients where I feel they may not necessarily have the level of education or understanding, then I really like to use the talk back method. I use it a lot in my patients who don't speak the same language as I do. So if I'm using an interpreter for some reason, I always have the patient tell me back what I told them, because it'll be very interesting. Then I would know exactly, hey, did they get the point across? So with the medication directions, what are the side effects that they're looking for? What are the specialists I want them to see? I want them to follow up with the ophthalmologist because they're on hydroxychloroquine. I'm like, well, this is what you're going to do in 6 months. And I expect the patient to tell me that. So that helps to reinforce the idea. And also lets me know that I was able to communicate properly and the patient understood I needed for them to understand, which also in turn helps improve compliance. And again, when we do that, I think the patient also feels that they have been listened to, that they've been taken seriously, and that we truly care for their well-being, which really goes a long way in improving their compliance with medications.
Excellent. Yeah, excellent. Excellent. Yeah, no, I think that's very important. Among the barriers, you know, I think you touched upon some of the barriers, but I'm wondering if there are any strategies that you've found helpful when financial resources are the limiting factor. They are the barrier. So, you know, medications not being affordable, maybe our patients, a good number of patients I've served in the past have been uninsured or underinsured. And so, you know, the medications and treatments can be quite costly. I mean, some of the things we talked about earlier are custom-built devices for reading and writing in patients with severe rheumatoid arthritis. Mm-hmm. Physical therapy may be not affordable if it's not covered within somebody's insurance plan. Have you found any strategies to be helpful when financial resources are the barrier for our patients?
Absolutely. So simple physical therapy, I think, is one of the easier ones. So a lot of times patients have insurance coverage, but they have a very high copay and they can't afford $50 a visit to the therapist, physical therapist. And if you have to go twice a week for 6 weeks, that amounts to a good amount of money. So a lot of times I have handouts for patients and I go through the exercises with the patient in the room. kind of quickly take about 5 minutes to go through them and say, hey, this is what I want you to do. And I give them directions, do it twice a week, 15 minutes. And I tell them, do it after a hot shower, because that's when your muscles are the most supple. It's easiest to do. Or after you do some cardio, that will be your best time to do the exercises. So giving them very clear directions, making sure that you're as precise as possible, and writing it on the handout saying 15 reps for twice a day for the next 6 weeks or for the next 12 weeks. When we do that for the patient, that seems to be very helpful for them to follow. When it comes to medication coverage, it is such a challenge for us because granted, a lot of the medicines we use in RA, like for example, the immunotherapy, they are very expensive. And some insurance is easy to get coverage, some insurances are not. So we do have to go through either a tier program where you have to try three medications before we get to the fourth one. We have to do peer-to-peer sometimes. Patients who are charity care, believe it or not, is actually easier. Because if I want infusions, I get them. It's a lot easier because they come under charity care. Our hospital does have it. But a lot of the companies have patient assistance programs.
Perfect.
So we do use them a lot in our patients, especially patients who are in the lower socioeconomic group, where we use the company copay cards or the company sponsors the medications. I have patients who I give samples to. We just work with the medical reps and we provide samples to patients to cover them through so that we can provide them with treatment. We use GoodRx for the oral DMARDs. We've used GoodRx a lot of times with patients so that we can get them the drugs that they need so that they can be covered. So there are some options. If they're in New Jersey, we have a PAD. PAD in New Jersey can also be helpful, which is again, you know, for subsidized rates, if for patients with low socioeconomic status, we can use that too, to get patients drugs. Standalone infusion centers can be helpful. So there are some methods to go about. It is not easy. It would be in my opinion, you need someone dedicated to who's going to do just this in your office. It's not in a physician's clinic time. It's very difficult to find the time to sit down and do these things. So, fortunately, in our office, we do have someone who does it, but these are avenues which are out there available to provide help to those patients who need much needed medications to live their life, you know, and to carry on and to work and provide, you know, earnings to their family, you know, who frequently depending on them for their day-to-day life. So there are some avenues out there, but they're challenging, but they are there.
Yeah, certainly can be a barrier to care for sure.
Absolutely.
For sure. But thank you. These are very helpful. Very, very helpful. Okay. Next question, which I think is a really important one. For me, it's about disparities of care, disparities among our patient groups. So are you noticing any disparities in, for example, let's just start with diagnosis. Are you noticing certain groups are just getting diagnosed not early enough, quite late, which then impacts their whole disease course. You know, I think it's important for us as primary care physicians to be aware of what those are so that we really, really can put RA on our radar and diagnose earlier. Can you talk a little bit about what you're seeing?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, this is one of the varied reasons is for a poor outcome. We look at patient outcomes with chronic diseases. Yes, so if you look at patient populations, we do see that patients of African-American descent and of Hispanic descent, they tend to have delayed diagnosis compared to patients of Caucasian descent. Okay. So it's a bias that we unfortunately have as providers. It's an unconscious bias and that we tend to miss diagnosis patients as having, you know, osteoarthritis or just chronic pain syndrome a lot of times. And not all the time are we doing a complete workup or hearing the patient when they're describing their symptoms to us. And sometimes it's also because of the barrier, like we talked about, it's a barrier. It could be a language barrier. You know, if it's somebody who doesn't speak the language that we speak and they're trying to explain symptoms, they may not necessarily say pain. They may call it weakness. They may call it burning. They may not call it discomfort. They may call it burning sensation in my joints. They may not describe stiffness. They may say that their hands feel tight. So there are different adjectives that patients use. And when you have a language barrier on top of that, yes, as a provider, you could really miss a lot of times you can miss these diagnoses if it's not on your radar. So if studies have shown that African-American patients of Hispanic descent, they are frequently getting diagnosed later than they should be compared to Caucasian patients when it comes to rheumatoid arthritis. And then when you translate that to the next step, we're talking about treatment. So now you've already lost that time where you could have intervened a lot sooner, and
yes,
you make the diagnosis a lot later, and now you're trying to institute therapy. So you've already lost that time. So now we're going to have a bigger, a more steep hill to climb now to get these patients to where you want to get to. So when it comes to diagnosis, when it comes to treatment as well, it's been shown that we patients who are Hispanic descent, for example, African-American descent, I should say, they're less likely to be given a biologic or an immunotherapy compared to somebody of Caucasian descent.
Oh, interesting. Interesting.
Yeah, so studies have shown and it's interesting also that Hispanic patients are more likely to be started with a biologic. There was one paper that, if I'm not mistaken, came out from New York a few years ago that said Hispanics patients got biologics for whatever reason offered to them before it was offered to an African-American patient. So even if treatment wise, we tend to have this unconscious bias in terms of when we are treating patients. And then if you look at insurance, that also leads to an issue too, because if as a provider, you're taking care of a patient, you have somebody who's got a poor insurance plan, you're already in your mind, you're thinking, well, I'm not going to get this drug approved. So you're less likely to use something that you know would be the first line of therapy because you know it may not get approved, and you're losing something which is probably going to be less effective for this patient, even though you know something better is out there. But because you know you're going to go through all these barriers as a provider, you may choose not to. So unfortunately, doing a disservice to the patient. So that also has been shown that this is another disparity that we have in our practice, day-to-day practice, which unfortunately will affect our patients negatively.
So you are seeing disparities in diagnosis, you're seeing disparities in treatment. How mm-hmm. about remission? Because that's where we want to get our patients. We want all of them to be in remission. Mm-hmm. We want them, you know, as close to symptom-free as possible. Are you seeing any differences there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there was a paper that they looked at patients all the way from 2014 to, I want to say, 2017. And they looked at, they divided the population groups into Caucasians, African-Americans, and Hispanics. And over the years, they looked at patients going to remission. Every year, our remission rates were increasing in all the three population groups, right? Because we have better treatment modalities, better diagnostic tests. So patients were doing better. But in looking at each population comparatively, it seemed like fewer patients in the African-American population and fewer patients in the Hispanic population were achieving end remission or low disease activity compared to patients of Caucasian descent. So even though there was success in that group, in those groups, right, we didn't see the success that we saw in our Caucasian group of patients. So even at remission rates, even though they're all available. And again, this could come to all the other things we talked about. We talked about insurance. We talked about language. It could be the fact that they can't afford or have a rheumatologist available to the patients.
Yes.
It would be education. When you're not educated enough to know how to treat the disease, so education part can also play a role. We do know patients of low socioeconomic status generally tend to do worse with these chronic diseases compared to others. So all of those factors probably play a role. But yes, to answer your question, remission rates are different in these different populations.
Yeah. So you're seeing a difference in the burden of the disease. That's mm-hmm. what you're seeing. That's what you're mm-hmm. saying.
Okay. Yeah. In looking from a financial standpoint as well, we do know a lot more of our African-American patients are the ones who are eventually requiring to go into disability, right? Applying for Medicaid or using opiates for chronic pain control compared to our Caucasian patients, which all translates to disease burden as well. So from a financial standpoint as well, that these patients tend to carry a greater burden than our Caucasian counterparts.
That's really important for us as providers to really be aware mm-hmm. so that we have because we have a potential to be able to intervene at any of these levels, really.
Absolutely.
All right. Excellent. I have, well, please forgive me for this question, but I'm going to indulge myself to ask this because my patients ask things like this all the time. With COVID, the topic that will never go away or doesn't seem to ever go away, are you noticing with COVID, and I'm thinking both in terms of active COVID infection, are there any things for me to keep in mind for my patients with rheumatoid arthritis who get COVID infection for me to consider? And then my second part is going to be also patients with long COVID, people gotten through the COVID infection, but still have lingering symptoms. Anything you're noticing in those patients who also have RA?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm hoping we've been looking at things the way it is now. Fortunately, we're not in the thick of it like we were a year or two ago. But yes, so with COVID, it definitely did. It did impact rheumatology, just like it impacted every other specialty, I should say. But in rheumatology patients, one of the biggest concerns were that our patients are all on immunosuppressants. All our medications, pretty much, almost all of them, the target is the immune system, and therefore the consequence is immunosuppression. So with patients who have COVID, one of the important things that we were trying to do as rheumatologists when we were in the thick of the pandemic was to educate the patients in terms of symptoms to watch for, make them understand that this is a real threat for you, and we want to make sure you're protected. So to understand what the disease is, COVID is, what symptoms to watch for, and then protecting themselves. So we were really encouraging vaccination in all our patients with RA who are on treatment, just to provide them with some protection against COVID, or at least reducing the disease activity to a minimum, to a relatively mild disease activity compared to the others. So that's one very, very important thing, you know, masking. We're encouraging patients to mask and so forth. The other important thing is, and this goes with patients with autoimmune diseases who are on immunosuppressants, the understanding that if they have an infection, if they have a fever, if they have to go on an antibiotic, if they have to have a surgical procedure of some sort done, just hold their immunosuppressants. That's very, very important, because you want the immune system to be as potent or as strong as possible to fight off the infections, except when it comes to hydroxychloroquine, which can be continued because it's not an immunosuppressant. Talking about long COVID, however, that's a different ball game. So with long COVID, it's really sad when our patients get long COVID symptoms, because one, it becomes a challenge to differentiate between that and their underlying rheumatic disease, and also to deal with another disease process altogether in addition to their autoimmune disease condition. So that's been an ongoing battle, but unfortunately, we don't have great treatment for long COVID. But again, a lot of it is to do with education. But a lot of patients, it seems like they've gotten better. The long COVID symptoms seem to eventually go away, especially if they've been vaccinated, as opposed to patients who are not vaccinated. So there is some light at the end of the tunnel in those patients as well.
Okay, wonderful. Wonderful. Dr. Prabhakaran, this has been amazing. Thank you so much. You've really been so generous, really, with your knowledge as well as your time. So I'm really, really grateful. I think that it gives us a tremendous amount to be able to think about, to be able to integrate as primary care providers, so that we can address not only the disparities that we've talked about during this session, but also be able to better diagnose and treat and manage rheumatoid arthritis in our patients. So thank you. Thank you for
Absolutely.
your great knowledge that you've shared with us. And thank you to our listeners. Thank you very much. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Yes. And if we can get some help out there, absolutely. Thank you so much.